This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's sponsor is CSN Mint, which has been providing certified U.S. Mint collectible coins and precious metals for over 20 years. They're one of the most trusted names in numismatics. In a topsy-turvy world, owning physical silver coins provides you with a tangible asset that you can hold in your hand. In times of economic uncertainty, having tangible assets can provide a sense of security and peace of mind. Explore CSN Mint's extensive catalog of bullion bars, coins, and numismatic collectibles. Whether you're a seasoned investor or a passionate collector, you're going to find a diverse range of products to suit all your needs and preferences. Every purchase includes the original certificate of authenticity or is certified and graded by a third-party grader to ensure origin and purity, and you're going to experience world-class customer service and support. Go to csnmint.com/interview and use the promo code interview at checkout, and you'll get a free silver American Eagle coin that's over a $30 value with your purchase of $75 or more. That's csnmint.com/interview, and make sure to use the promo code interview at checkout. My guest today is one of the great pioneers of podcasting. Hardcore History's Dan Carlin has been putting his thoughts out there for all to hear since the aughts and has deeply researched and urgently delivered takes on everything from Julius Caesar's war on the Celtic tribes of ancient Gaul to 20th century Imperial Japan's horrific conquest of Asia are downloaded by the millions. I talk with him about his upcoming live tour, how he would update his 2019 book, The End Is Always Near, Apocalyptic Moments from the Bronze Age Collapse to Nuclear Near Misses in Light of the COVID Pandemic, and whether he believes we can really learn meaningful lessons from history. Here is The Reason Interview with Dan Carlin. So, Dan Carlin, thank you for talking to Reason.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you're going on tour. What can fans of Hardcore History expect at a live show?
I always call them listeners. Fans seems a little self-aggrandizing for me. It's sort of a mini tour, testing the waters here. We'll see if there's what people think of the final product. Rather than give some sort of a presentation that's the same everywhere, I opted to do a sort of a question and answer with, for lack of a better word, a moderator on stage, and then open it up to the audience for questions. I figure that does two things. One, it means that no show is like any other show. Right. And it also assures that we're going to talk about what people want to hear, as opposed to me assuming that they're going to like something I do on stage and maybe have some people walk away displeased with what they got. So I hope it works out like I'm assuming. Yeah. We'll see.
Okay, and you're going to Los Angeles, Salt Lake, Portland, and New York. So you're really hitting very different kind of demographics, right?
Yeah, and you know, so they asked me when we were talking about getting the tour started, they wanted to sort of sample some places and just see what the reaction was. And they said, "Well, where do you go already?" And I said, "Well, you know, those four places are places I find myself for various reasons anyway." So they said, "Great." Mm-hmm. Those are four very different places, and we'll get a good idea of what the demand is in those four areas.
Do you have a sense of, I mean, your podcast, Hardcore History, gets downloaded by the millions. Like, do you have a sense of where your listeners are? Are they all over the place? Or, you know, what's the demographic? And as we used to talk about in the rock mag business 1,000 years ago when I was involved in that, the psychographic, you know, who are your listeners, and what do you think they're getting out of the show?
Well, forever we've been told in all the, you know, reputable advisement magazines or whatever's out there that we need to do more demographic research. But, you know, coming from my perspective that I've always had, I don't like when people do that to me. And so I don't like the idea of doing it to them. So I don't ask them questions about themselves or delve into who they are or what they make or, you know, where they live and how old they are and what their religious beliefs are. But the podcasting tools that are out there now give us more information than they used to. And so you can say certain things, like you can say what states they're listening to you in the United States, what countries they're listening to you in, and those kinds of things. And basically, it, you know, when we started, I feel like it was much more U.S. centric, and now the international audience is growing more. And you know, obviously, the big population centers, you have more people listening than in Wyoming, but that's because people don't like you in Wyoming. It's just there's less people in Wyoming. So to give you a real answer, though, no, I don't know a ton about the listeners, and I don't want to. I feel like, you know, their privacy is valuable to them like mine is to me. And I feel like what the podcasting services give us is enough.
You know, it's interesting. Brian Lamb, the guy who, you know, the true radical who invented C-SPAN, you know, and kind of turned a surveillance camera on Congress and whatnot. He stepped down a few years ago, but he said that they never did ratings because they don't want to know, you know, they don't want to start playing to the audience. And that even if you aren't under pressure to do that, once you know who your audience is, you'll start playing to it. And it seems to me like, I mean, you've been doing this for, you know, well over a decade, you know, almost 20 years now, right? And do you feel that way? I mean, like, in a way, you don't want to be narcissistic or solipsistic, but like, why would you want to know who is paying attention, or, you know, when you have big numbers anyway?
Well, part of it is an advertising thing, right? So advertisers want to know that information. Yeah. We don't really, I mean, we do a tiny bit sometimes, but most of our shows don't have any ads at all. Because to be honest, I don't like being a pitch man very much. I had to do it when I was in radio. You don't have a choice. But I always felt a little dirty unless I really liked the product. And then when you start doing the podcast, I had the advantage of being able to just say, well, if I don't either use it for real or if I don't like it, like we did Audible, the audiobooks for a while. Right. And I'm a big proponent of reading. So it was easy we always read the reviews to make sure that even if you like the concept behind the business, that they're treating the customers well. And so I'm happy to do those kind of things, but we don't do much advertising. So it's a luxury for me to be able to say, we don't care about the demographics because we don't care. And the advertisers that might care, we really don't deal with very much. So that was easy. I see your point about the playing to the audience, but I have a different attitude about that. And I feel like we self-select our audience. And somebody told me a long time ago that if you just do the shows that interest you, the people that don't like the things that interest you will eventually go away. And the people that stay with you that you can reliably assume like the same things you do. And so when you pick something you want to talk about, the audience has sort of already been self-selected. And so that's kind of I don't know if that's true, but that's what I go with.
Let's say not since you've been doing hardcore history, but back in your radio days, what was the worst product that you pitched for that you were just, you know, throwing up a little bit in your mouth as you were announcing it?
Oh God, that's a long time ago now. Let me think about that. You know, off the top of my head, I can't remember, but you know, it was a lot of restaurants or, you know, I wasn't a national show, so we didn't get those kind of national commercials. But there was, it's funny though. I mean, I don't feel like they were too terrible because everybody on the station had to read the same ads. They weren't specifically buying for me. So it didn't sound like endorsing it. But I always did prefer if they would just run an advertisement on the show rather than have me do what's called a live read where you had to sound like you were endorsing something.
But that's what everybody wants, right? You use this feminine deodorant spray, right? Because it makes you feel like a total woman or something like that. In 2019, and you came on this podcast to talk about it, you published The End Is Always Near, Apocalyptic Moments from the Bronze Age Collapse to Nuclear Near Misses. And this book came out just a few months before COVID, you know, became the latest, you know, End Is Always Near or Apocalyptic Moment. How did you feel about that? Did you feel like you were conjuring up material for the paperback or something?
Well, here's the thing. I'm a perfectionist is not the right word, but I like to really feel like, you know, with the podcast, obviously we have no release dates. And the reason it takes so long is because I really am always trying to do a better job. But when you deal with a book contract, they want their book when they think they're going to get their book. And so it turned out I felt a little rushed at the end with that book, but they pushed and pushed and pushed. And then when COVID hit, like, 3 or 4 months after the book came out, I remember thinking to myself, well, shoot, had it been up to me, I would have missed that because the book would have come out 2 months after COVID hit and that whole chapter would have been ruined.
Yeah.
But I never felt any, you know, there was no warm, fuzzy feelings about having thought about that before it happened because, you know, millions of people are being affected.
Right.
And to be honest, and you know, I mean, I know a lot of people, I know the standard technique is to claim credit for all these things. But I mean, really, I was like one of the last people on the bandwagon saying, you know, we're vulnerable to another pandemic. I mean, there were a lot of people running around for years saying, yeah, warning, warning, warning. And, you know, we had near misses. We had, you know, avian flu and you had things like
SARS and MERS,
virus in Africa and all that kind of stuff. So you know, it didn't take a genius to see that coming. I do think the timing was just a little weird.
Did you see an uptick in your podcasts? I remember when COVID hit and the lockdown started, it seemed at first that the market for podcasts seemed to kind of collapse a little bit because people weren't commuting to work anymore. But do you think, you know, particularly the kind of program that you offer where it's like deep dives into sometimes the distant past, sometimes more recent, was that, you know, were you providing the electrolytes that plants crave, to steal a line from Idiocracy? I mean, were people more interested in what you were talking about during the pandemic or less, or did you notice any difference?
I think it's like binge watching on TV. We actually did, again, this sounds awful, we did well during the COVID thing. Yeah. And we've seen a drop off since, but I think it's because, you know, people are back at work working, you know, and things like that. I think we had a time period where people were stuck in the house with nothing to do, or they were doing, when we're doing audio podcasts, one of the real benefits of audio over video is that you don't have to watch something, and you could be mowing the lawn or ironing a shirt or making dinner and still have the ability to sort of multitask. And so I feel like during COVID, people took the opportunity to listen to what we were doing while they were doing something else, or just, you know, we were a good time waster, right? My shows are long.
I will tell you, I recently started listening to, I listen to podcasts usually on Spotify, and, you know, so they have an algorithm. When one episode ends, it goes either to the same show, to the next one, or something similar. But I have woken up over the past couple of weeks, you know, where I wake up and I'm having kind of weird dreams and I feel uncomfortable. And then I realize I've been listening to you describe the ways in which ancient civilizations like flayed their victims and things like that. And I feel kind of like we've been in a world like that. I wanted to ask, related to the end is always near and the nuclear near misses. And I think it was recently in an addendum episode or something, but I remember you were talking, or actually it's an older, addendum. You were talking to the guys who host The Rest is History, which is a very good British kind of history podcast. And the question was something like, did America have to, like, you know, was it preordained that America would win the Cold War? And you talked a lot about John F. Kennedy actually kind of saying no to all of his advisors in the way that he dealt with a lot of the things around the Cuban Missile Crisis. Are you a believer, broadly speaking, in a big man theory of history that, you know, I mean, or I guess my question, just try and put it succinctly, is like, is history is it the story of massive forces that sweep over whole periods of time, or is it about heroic individuals who actually change the course of history?
Well, I was reading something that historian Adrian Goldsworthy wrote recently, where he was talking a little about that. And he was saying that while it's kind of discredited to think about individuals having such an outsized role on history, he said, all we have to do, though, is look at current events and see how much the personalities of single individuals seem to be important to how current events play out, to understand that this would have been the dynamic in the past also. Now, I think we all understand that there's an interplay between these people and the opportunities that they have because of what's going on in the world, the times we live in, and all these other things. for them to do what they do. So if you get an outsized personality on the scene, and they're driving a lot of events, I think it's fair to ask yourself, okay, well, would this person have been able to do this with the conditions we were living under 30 or 40 years ago? So mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of an axis of two lines crossing, and one line is the personality of the people involved. The other axis are the events, the trends, the forces of the times we live in. Yeah. And when those things intersect, I think that's when you hit that sweet spot where all of a sudden you're looking at some personality and you go, you know, if not for that person, I mean, for example, you mentioned Kennedy. The way my mind works is I always try to imagine as a way of trying to get some perspective is plug somebody else in that role. Right. If Richard Nixon wins the 60 election and he's the one handling the Cuban Missile Crisis, does it go the same or does it go differently? Or better yet, what if the Cuban Missile Crisis happens a few years earlier and you have General Eisenhower in the White House? Yeah. So, I mean, those are fun ways in my mind of trying to sort of game this out to get a little bit of perspective about, you know, what's more important here, the trends and the forces or the individual involved. Because if you say it would have turned out the same with Nixon or Eisenhower as it did with Kennedy, then you start to think maybe it's a more of a trends and forces ascendant moment. But right. if you say, I don't think it does turn out the same with those other people. Well, then you can, I think, actively say that having Kennedy in the White House at that place and time and under those circumstances actually made history go in a different direction than it otherwise would.
Yeah. Do you have historical figures that you consider heroes? And if so, you know, what's your criteria? Not necessarily for great men of history or great women of history. You know, people like Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, you know, these are giant figures. But are there people that you look back to and you say, you know what, these people were good people who made the world a better place? Or is that not really how you approach either, you know, history or figures?
Oh man, I should have a ready answer to a question like that, shouldn't I? It's funny, but off the top of my head, no one comes immediately to mind, but that's not because there aren't people that I greatly admire. Mm-hmm. I think personality wise, I am not much of a hero worshiper. That doesn't mean that I don't find, I mean, first of all, sometimes I look at people and I just wonder if I could have done what they did. So, for example, you look at people who, like in the civil rights struggle in the 1950s and 1960s, when you look at the death threats that those people got, I always ask myself, okay, would I have forged ahead knowing that people are talking about, you know, hurting my kids or firebombing my house or those kinds of things? To me, you know, rather than the hero side of it, which is not really part of my personality, right. Sometimes I measure myself though against these other people and just say, man, I might be craven or cowardly or selfish. I'm not sure. Yeah. So, I mean, there's admiration there, but not hero worship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no. And not too long ago, a guy named Daniel Axt wrote a book called War by Other Means, which was a study of conscientious objectors during World War II. And these are, you know, and particularly Bayard Rustin and David Dellinger, who, you know, both Rustin played a major role in the civil rights movement, you know, and was a gay black man who refused to be inducted into, you know, the army during World War II and went to prison. And Dellinger was a Quaker and a pacifist who ended up being part of the Chicago 7 trial. And I don't necessarily agree with them at all on the question of conscientious objecting to World War II. But it's like looking at those guys and what they put up with. I mean, it was like being, you know, under a mile underwater with the pressure on you to just cave. It's pretty remarkable. And, you know, I'm sure you are familiar with that picture of, you know, there's the guy in the Nazi rally who is refusing to salute. Yeah. You know, I think we tend to think that we're going to be the person who stands out in a crowd, but, you know, we're probably kidding ourselves.
Well, if nothing else, you know, it's the old line of these are the times that try men's souls. I mean, you look at these kinds of things and you just go, would I have been the one to shelter a Jewish person in occupied Europe. I mean, all these things where you, and you know, of course, those are the tests. You don't know till you get there. But I do feel like when I read these stories, rather than hero worship, I sometimes feel a little shamed by the whole thing and worried about how I might react in the same situation. So there's admiration for sure.
I mean, even at the school board meetings, right? When you're you're not raising your hand quite enough or speaking
that's up. Not a problem. I can talk, and you that. But I mean, these are the real dangerous things, though. These are the kind of things where you go, God, please don't let me be tested. You know.
You know, you you define yourself as a pessimist, kind of, or and maybe that's not right. Maybe you're a realist, but it, you know, one of the things that you're show or your podcast shows again and again is that all societies collapse, all civilizations end at some point. And in that sense, they're kind of pessimistic, although you're not, you know, I also hear you, you know, talking about how things get better or different and things like that. But, you know, are you, you know, when you think about something like COVID happening, are you, do you feel like we've gotten to a better place or are, you know, are you a long-term pessimist, short-term optimist? Are you a mid-range person? Like how do you define yourself and how do you apply the lessons of history that you kind of analyze and dig out in your podcast into, you know, your lifespan?
You know, to me, that's kind of a macro micro question because I think on a micro level, like an individual human level, there are always bad places to find yourself, right? Bottom of the economic scale, trapped in a murderous dictatorship like North Korea. So, I mean, I feel like on an individual level, there's awful places to be in any period in history, and they're probably equally terrible to some degree or another. On a macro level, there are obviously times and places that are better than others, right? And so I think that sometimes you're lucky to find yourself in a nation that's technologically sophisticated, wealthy on the macro level of things. You know, healthcare if you get hurt, you know, not too many invasions in during your lifetime, things like that. I do think not so much that it's cyclical, because I think that brings up certain theories of history that are arguable, but I do think you feel like nothing lasts forever, whether it's good times or bad times. And so I think sometimes this idea that that we're living in a particular good time or a particular bad time ending isn't so much pessimistic. I think it's just realizing in the same way that, listen, I'm 58 years old right now and life is good, but you can't help but notice that when you're 58, life isn't going to be good forever. Right. So I don't think that's being pessimistic to just know that all good things must pass and hopefully all bad things must pass because change is inevitable. And if things are good, what does change mean? Right. So I do think that maybe from the perspective where we're looking at this 20th century or 21st century American citizen, for example, in the grand historical scheme, you're living in one of the best times and best places to ever be around. So the likelihood of that getting better versus the likelihood of that getting worse would seem to indicate that that change is likely to bring a lessening of the good things just because we've had it so good so long. But it doesn't mean it has to happen. It's an odds game, right? Maybe the odds are just 70-30 against wonderful things continuing. But, you know, people have made money in Vegas with odds worse than that.
Yeah. And I think it was in an episode or an interview that you did with Rick Rubin, the record producer, where you mentioned that your father was a Korean war vet.
Well, he was in the, as he would say, he was in the Navy. So it doesn't quite count the same as being like at the Chosin Reservoir or something like that. He was eating ice cream on an aircraft carrier.
But he also, he grew up pretty poor, right?
Yeah, really poor.
So, you know, I'm a couple years older than you. My father served in World War II, was an infantryman. And I feel in a profound way that I lucked out tremendously by escaping a lot of history. Do you feel, I mean, you just said like the odds might be 70-30 or things like that. Do you feel like for your kids, do you think we'll go back to a world that is like the ones that our parents might have grown up in, where you know, there is grinding poverty and there is, you know, just kind of war is taken for granted. I think back a lot to my parents who were both born in the 20s. They were the children of immigrants and, you know, they grew up during the Depression. Then there was World War II. And then, you know, when World War II ended, they were like, okay, well, you know, it's good. Like people aren't being killed as much anymore, but we're still going to be poor. And then, you know, something happened and they stopped being poor. Do you think we might see a reversal like that in our lifetimes?
Well, I think that's macro, micro also. In the macro sense, look, from an international relations standpoint, you don't have to be a genius to see that the situation, you know, let me back up and say that I always think about things in much longer time frames than most people, just because that's how I try to make sense of history. It's not better, it's not worse, it's just how I do it. So I always imagine like 50 or 60 or 70 years not being all that long in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
If you look at it through that sort of a time frame, you can't help but notice that we've been living as Americans anyway, and I know your audience is international, but just from an American standpoint, we've been living in the post-Second World War, you know, dual superpower, United States being the only country with a really functioning economy and not hurt in the Second World War amongst all the great powers. That's a temporary situation. Now, if it's a 70-year temporary situation, that's a lifetime. So it seems like a long time to my mom, born in 1938. All she can really remember is that era. But we're exiting that era now and returning to what, you know, they would have probably called in the 1920s a return to normalcy in an international relations sense. Not hegemony, but a multi-power world. I mean, look at the number of powers you had before both world wars. It's between 4 and 6 major powers.
Yeah.
That's much more normal than having two hegemonic powers facing off against each other with their alliance systems. So I think from a military macro standpoint, international relations, I think you're going to see things we haven't seen in a while. I think we already see things we haven't seen in a while, including a real change in warfare, which is going to upset things, what they call an RMA, a revolution in military affairs. And people don't always notice these things so much when they're happening. But I mean, for example, look at how drones in the war between Russia and Ukraine have sunk ships. That's going to be such a huge thing. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal today about the mixing of drones, mass swarms of drones, with future artificial intelligence capabilities, right? Getting them to work together. And what that would mean for things like big, expensive surface ships. Well, those are the kind of things that change the world. I mean, they don't seem like that big of a thing, but if all of a sudden a $13 billion aircraft carrier is a vulnerable piece of floating hardware, and you can't use those anymore, and if something like the United States is power projection is based on a weapon system like that, well, then you can see how all of a sudden that makes things topsy-turvy. And the funny thing that most people don't understand necessarily is how this sort of military question actually resonates and pings off of a lot of non-military things that affect our lives. Now, in the micro sense of the word, when you get away from like these big power changes that we were talking about, I don't know. I don't know is the answer. Rephrase the question for me. I'll see if I can frame it in more micro terms.
You know, I guess I might want to stick with the idea of like what happens when we go back to a world that has, you know, half a dozen or a dozen powers, you know, the mix of global people who can project global force as well as regional force, because that does seem to be where we're headed. And I'm, you know, we're both of a similar vintage. So I was thinking of, you know, when I was in college, I was told like you know, the smart people are going to be studying either Russian or Japanese, because those are the two powers that are going to be, you know, those are the languages of the future. And, you know, that didn't work out so well. But the fact is Japan is still a major power. Russia is still a major power, even if the Soviet Union doesn't exist. But then you throw in China and whatnot. And I guess my, you know, maybe this gets at something similar. How, you know, you focus a lot, and I'm thinking about, you know, the the series that you did, Supernova in the East, about Imperial Japan, is, you know, stayed with me because I, you know, the depth of that. And I'll tell you a funny story that you, I think you'll appreciate. My fiance was on a business trip in Japan, and she started listening to it as a way of like learning about Japanese culture, which was really not a good idea. But she said at one point on a packed subway in Tokyo, her earbuds came out. And so you were describing one of the horrible tortures that Imperial Japanese soldiers were visiting upon Asia at the time. And she was like really worried that if anybody understood English, they would, you know, see her as an enemy. But, you know, is world history ultimately military history, or is it the history of trade? Is it the history of migration? You know, where do you see those kind of lines intersecting?
Well, I often talk about this when I'm talking about why people are interested in history, whether they know it or not. And that's because history is everything that's ever happened. And so what I always tell, like, sometimes I'll do speaking engagements with schools, and you'll have middle school students or high school students that really don't want to hear some guy talk to them about history. And what I try to teach them is that because of the way history has to be segmented into so-called important events or important dates, or that's a construct of historians. And what choice do they have, right? I mean, imagine writing the history book of everything. Yeah. You can't do that, right? So the main thing that historians try to do is find out what's important. I mean, even these chapters where we decide one era has ended and another began is part of the human construct of just trying to organize everything that's ever happened. So what I tell students is that the truth is that you don't necessarily have to understand when Columbus stumbled upon the Americas. That's an important event according to somebody else. If you're interested in motorcycles or fashion or dentistry, or dogs, or whatever you're interested in, there is a history of that. And that's part of the past too. So the answer, the actual idea is that there is no rule about what's important in the past. What's important in the past is what is important to you. And then it has a past. And the most important thing in my mind, and this is what I tell the students, is context and understanding how things go from where they were to how they are. So what I always tell these kids, I say, if you're interested in motorcycles, find the first motorcycle ever built and find the one that just came out yesterday, and then trace the development from the one to the other, right? So you start to see the process of change and historical development and how things move over a course of decades or whatever. And that teaches you the idea of, you know, the history of moving events. And then ask yourself, when you're looking at these different motorcycles over the different eras, why they are the way they are, right? I mean, is this the engine that they're using at the time? And why did a new engine come? And it teaches you the context that creates the circumstances about how these new motorcycles get developed, why they have these new features, these new parts. And so between the two of them, the context and the idea of historical change, you're getting the most important part. People are going to forget 1492, most of them, the minute the test is over and they leave the classroom. But they're not going to forget the important parts of context and the historical change process if they learn it with something that they're already interested in and that has a past that's as much a part of the grand history of things as anything else is.
That, you know, it's interesting when you're talking. I find that completely convincing. I notice that you don't say the word progress. Do you believe in progress, or do you think that that's, you know, kind of a badly value laden term that kind of obfuscates as much as it clarifies?
Maybe the latter, only because progress is an eye of the beholder thing. First of all, second of all, I think progress assumes that it's sort of a one way street. I kind of love. There's a book called Global Catastrophic Risk that I fell in love with. It's edited by a guy named Nick Bostrom, who works at the what's it called? It's something like the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford or whatever. And every chapter of the book is written by a different expert, and every chapter is sort of a way the world could end. And it's a fascinating book. But in the introduction of the book, Bostrom writes about what he calls existential threat. And I was always taught that existential threat means like elimination, right? So an existential threat to humanity means humanity just goes away, disappears, the last person dies, and it's over. But he has a different definition of it. And one of the definitions of existential threat, it includes the everybody goes away one, but it also includes if humanity gets knocked backwards in terms of capabilities and never again reaches its former abilities. So if you imagine that we have a nuclear war and that we lose the ability to put a man on the moon and we never get that back, right? To him, that's an existential outcome. And in your question about progress, that implies that we're never going to move backwards. And I think that history has shown over and over that, well, doesn't mean you can. I mean, that you will, but it means you can, right? I mean, look at the post-Roman Empire when you've got crumbling aqueducts and you can't replace them. Well, that's a little like the thing we said about not being able to go back to the moon when you've already been. Or losing an internet and never getting one back. So I don't know if, to me, progress implies an ever moving single direction towards bigger, better things and improved capabilities. And I think that that's not a given. I think like striking a match, it's possible that, for example, the Roman Empire or China at its height in earlier eras was striking a match and having it snuffed out before we finally get the roaring fire going for good. Maybe having a global world environment prevents a collapse of one segment of the globe from reducing. I mean, for example, had the Roman Empire been in contact with the rest of the world during that time period, maybe that prevents things from going backwards because there's a China to relight the pilot light, so to speak. I don't know. But to me, progress, there's a teleological aspect to progress that I'm not sure I buy into. But look, I'm always hoping for better things, but I'm not sure it's a given that things are always going to get better.
Do you feel like, you know, and I don't, yeah, go ahead.
I think just maybe that's the pessimism you talked about earlier.
Yeah. I don't believe in golden ages really, but we are, to the extent that they are, you know, defensible, we're in a golden age of people being able to dig into the past of their own making, you know, of creating their own usable past. And do you find that when you talk to younger people or when you talk to people your age or older, are they more into the idea of understanding that the past is, you know, certain things happened and other things did not happen, but, you know, the past is kind of an infinite attic or cellar where you can rummage through and construct a lot of different stories that help you make sense of where you are and who you want to be and where you want to go, both, you know, on an individual level as well as on a societal level. And do you feel like people are cognizant of that and they're taking, you know, they're taking advantage of, you know, just the massive amount of information that is available to us that wasn't available, you know, in the mid 70s or the 80s, you know, and things like that? Or are people, you know, do we tend to take, you know, kind of advances in knowledge or in possibilities just for granted and then kind of become satisfied with where we are?
You know, I don't know how to answer that because I don't know what people are doing. I can say that what I notice, for example, and this is always a problem, it's not like this is new, but it's specifically something that I notice now, and maybe it just grates on me more. I feel like we've never been more likely to judge people from the past by current modern moral sensibilities, which is always something that I feel like obscures the past rather than illuminates it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things, I had a professor once who was so good at trying to get us to put ourselves in the shoes of people from the past and ask the question, when they do things that we think are despicable now, was that their goal? Right? Were they trying to do despicable things?
Yeah.
And I think going from memory here, but we were talking about people who tried to convert natives to Christianity. And the current line of thinking at the time was that this was an awful thing to do. We were destroying native cultures and their belief systems and forcibly taking them away from their families and teaching them, you know, the white man's religion. And we can determine now that that was a huge loss in terms of what those people could have preserved of their native culture and belief system and passed on to their children and all these kinds of things. But was that the goal at the time, to do something negative? And he said, no, he said, you have to look at the way those people who did the converting saw the world. You can see it with the Spanish when they came to the New World. If you literally believe that your view of religion is correct and that there is a fiery place called hell that you will go to if you don't believe what they tell you to believe or what they believe, and then they convert somebody to believing that, then they think they've done a good thing. Now, that doesn't mean they have done a good thing, but when we look back on the past and judge people, I hate the judging thing, but when we judge people, we do so because every generation before us has done the exact same thing. We judge people based on our own modern sensibilities, whenever modern is, right? And I think then we infuse people in the past sometimes with sort of evil overtones that if you could bring them back in a time machine would confuse and befuddle them. Not because they didn't do something that we could objectively look at today and say is bad, but because that wasn't their goal at all. And they thought they were doing good. And the reason I bring this up is because it's very, very, very possible, in fact, almost inevitable, that the same thing's going to happen with us.
Down
the road in the future, they're going to look back on us and absolutely demonize us for any number of things that we couldn't possibly know was going to be the thing to be. I mean, airplane travel, eating meat, experimentation on animals,
Owning pets. Yeah. I mean, you make me think of, there was a book that was very popular in the, antebellum America by a popular writer named Lydia Maria Child. And she was writing before, Nathaniel Hawthorne, really, but she writes a story that's set in Salem, in colonial Salem. And she talks about how, you know, we now look at the Puritans as, you know, ridiculously closed-minded, horrible people. And we should kind of think of them as, you know, understand them in context. And her book ends, Hobomok, I'm going to ruin it for people. It was published, you know, like 170 years ago. So I feel like the statute of limitations has, expired on spoiler alerts, but it ends with an Indian, a Native American, who the main character has a child with, kind of disappearing and just being literally and figuratively written out of the story. And you read the book now, and she's trying to make a point that you just made. And from a modern sensibility today, you're like, oh my God, this is an incredibly racist book that depends on the erasure of Native Americans. And so we're always like that. And I know, I think it was in an addendum episode with the Rest Is History guys, where you were talking about Thomas Jefferson, who, you know, obviously is a morally complex and in many ways just a compromised character, but that he also gave rise to a kind of matrix of rights that were used by people like Frederick Douglass and others to argue for their rights. So history is much more complex than we ever really kind of want it to be at any given moment.
No, and I come from a family tradition. I had a grandfather that was very big on don't judge other people until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And this was really hammered into us. And it turned out to be a really good tool when I got into history as a history major, because the one thing that, and you know, the funny thing is you can go back to the ancient Romans. I mean, this was, you read their histories in air quotes. A lot of it, like, go read ancient Greeks like Plutarch. I mean, Plutarch's entire work on Lives, which is his famous book, is he's comparing historical figures to each other, this person against that person, this person against, and what he's trying to do is make sort of moral judgments even then. This is ingrained in us somehow to want to say this person's bad, this person's good, but the criteria we're using is the criteria of whatever time we're doing the assessment in. Yeah. And that is an inherently flawed problem because that's a moving target. Right. The moral sensibilities are always changing, which is why you can look at a lot of historical figures look at Alexander the Great. Depending on the era you're assessing that guy in, he comes off as awesome or terrible.
Right.
And then sometimes back again.
Yeah.
And so it's to me, that's not a bug, though. That's a feature, because I think that to me makes history much more interesting than if we have evil figures and good figures, and those figures are permanently, you know, in stone in their positions. History is a moving target. Yeah. There's also, and this I tell people all the time too, They don't realize that history is not like math, right? It's not 2 + 2 = 4. There's a Fox News version of history, an MSNBC version of history. And if, depending on which source you grab from which era, you're going to get a completely different spin on the events, how they occurred, who's responsible, and what they mean.
I like it when we, you know, when we complicate things, not to the degree where you can't make decisions, but, and I also know this has come up in various episodes and podcasts that you've done, but somebody like Winston Churchill, depending on, you know, if you're raised in, generally speaking, in America or England, you love Winston Churchill. It's not complicated. He was the ascent. He was the man who saved the, you know, the West. But if you're from the Indian subcontinent, you have a radically different view of Winston Churchill. And we shouldn't pretend as if, you know, one side or the other doesn't exist. We should really kind of sit with the complications and kind of try and work things out rather than dismiss that, which is, you know, which makes us have to work to understand things better.
And there's also the getting back to the judging someone by the context of the times. You know, sometimes I ask myself, what's realistic to imagine someone doing? Now, we should point out that someone like Churchill lived long enough and was involved in politics long. He didn't die till 1965.
Yeah,
yeah. Born in the 19th century, right? So, and was active politically almost that whole time. So we're talking about a figure that spanned, you know, the British Empire at its height to the to the post-war British, you know, coming down from imperial heights. So this is a person that in the whole second half of his career was somewhat of a political dinosaur. And so contextually speaking, he had detractors during his lifetime and political career. And before the Second World War broke out, there were a lot of people that thought he was a warmonger and all these. So that's a wonderful example of what we were talking about earlier when the axis gets crossed between the individual meeting the proper time and place, right? The Second World War, and Churchill knew it. I think he said something like, you know, if he could go back in time, he would always choose May 1940. You know, that was his moment and he knew it. So, but to me, someone like Churchill, you have to ask yourself how much that guy could have been different given where he came from, his influences growing up. I mean, and again, to me, that's a little like what we talked about earlier, where you're judging the Spanish priest for what he's doing, trying to save people from hell. How much did that guy have any agency in thinking any differently? So I don't want to write off good and evil in the past, because I think that there's a, if you take this too far the wrong way, it makes you not able to judge Hitler, right? Or not able to judge Stalin. So we have to be careful. But at the same time, I do try to sit there and go, okay, these people are all products of their time and political and social environment and the civilization they came from. And we have to take that into account too, might be a good way to put it.
So let me ask you two questions to go here. One is, how do you decide what you're going to get into, or does, you know, do your topics find you? I mentioned Supernova in the East, which is a real achievement. I mean, just of you being able to sustain, you know, that level of intensity and engagement with the topic. The Celtic Holocaust series is, you know, amazing too. But like, do you go looking for just these horrifying kind of episodes in the past, or do they find you?
Well, first of all, you're really kind. I appreciate that. I'm not always as easy on myself as you are on me, right? Yeah,
well, you know, this is, I wake up to it in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh my God. Thankfully, it's not me. It's, you know, it's you speaking into my ear.
The thankfully it's not me thing, though, is part of the motivation. I mean, a lot of these stories, that's what makes me think of them as interesting, right? Oh, my God, can you imagine being here and these people in this time period? Yeah. So I mentioned self-selection of the topics earlier. Mm-hmm. If I'm interested in it, that right there is requirement number one, because we don't have scripts for these shows. So I don't read them and then think, okay, I'll write a script for this and then I'll record it. I just go in and record it. And so it's based on inspiration. And so if I'm not into the topic, it just doesn't work. You would hear it in my voice, right? It's also why I can't talk about certain things. I'll get requests from people like, you know, can you please talk about 17th century India? And I'll have to say no. I said, because I don't know anything about 17th century India, and I couldn't learn enough about it in the short span of, you know, it's funny, the listeners think it's forever between shows, but if you're trying to educate yourself from ground zero, it's a short amount of time. So all of these topics we choose, number one requirement is I have to be interested in them. Number two requirement is I have to have some foundation of knowledge that we can then build upon. And so all these topics that we do shows on, I knew something about before we did them. And then a lot of what I'm learning is what I've gotten wrong by reading histories from a long time ago. Cause a lot of these stories, there's a lot of new histories that I haven't read since the last time I was heavily into the topic, and that turns the tables on a lot of the old ideas about what really happened and who was responsible. And you know, sometimes secrets come out that were not available when there's a lot of stuff in the Second World War we know now that even when I was a kid growing up, we didn't know. Enigma machines, for example, stuff like that. I have to know something about it. I have to be interested in it. And as far as what I'm interested in, well, you know, a lot of these stories you may have noticed have what we call here when I'm doing them, spines, philosophical spines. The ancient historian Thucydides said once that history is philosophy taught by example. That's another one of those things that gets a lot of flack today because in some senses it's wrong, but in some senses it's not. And in the senses that it's not wrong, we try to find some deeper philosophical question that the story sort of highlights. So we did one called The Destroyer of Worlds, which was about the early years of trying to live with nuclear weapons, right? Mm-hmm. And the spine in that one is, can human beings learn to live with the power of their ever-evolving weapon system? So even if you manage to live with what we have today and design systems and safeguards and everything, what happens when you invent the next most powerful weapon system after that? So that's an idea, a philosophical question that runs through the entire show. And most of the shows we do, not all of them, because I don't want to ever have a formula or slip into a rut or have a format. So we sometimes switch it up just to be different and get out of the sameness of it all. But most of the shows have a philosophical throughput idea that we're trying to explore. And a lot of times that's the first thing that makes me go, aha, well, this would be a good thing to talk about because exploring that philosophical throughput idea would be interesting. And so those are the things those are the many things that have to cross together to make me go, ah, that would be a fun show. And then the last thing is more of a practical thing. I will look at the shows that we've recently done, and I try to look at the archives the same way I look at history, right? Trying to imagine it 10 or 15 or 20 years from now and say, okay, do we have a nice mix? Because we usually keep about 10 shows free, and then we move them to the paid archive after four or 5 years. And I try to make sure we have enough diversity, subject matter diversity in the 10 or so free shows, so that if you didn't like Supernova in the East, which was about the Second World War in the Pacific and Asian theater, and we have six maybe shows on that, do I have a couple shows then from widely differing periods so you could go, oh, I'm really not interested in that. Oh, but I like the idea of the Romans and the Celtic people, so I'll listen to that show. So there is some attempts to try to switch it up a little bit in terms of historical periods or throughput ideas or that kind of thing.
Do you what would you say is the happiest show that you've done?
Oh, that's a trick question, isn't it? Let me think about this one for a minute. Happiest show that I've done. I did one once called The Organization of Peace that was about the League of Nations, and there was the whole League of Nations thing is this almost rainbows and unicorns attempt to try to imagine a better world through a sort of a shared understanding that we had just been through the worst war in the history of the world, right, and we never want to go through that again. And there were so many fun aspects of it, like the idea, and it was a minor idea, it was never like this major League of Nations proposal, but the idea of Esperanto, right? The idea that, you know, we have to have human beings communicate better if we want to avoid the kinds of things that happened before. So we all need to speak the same language, right? So there's a lot of hopeful stuff in that show because the League of Nations itself was almost a naive attempt to hope for a better world and try to figure out what the heck would be involved in working towards it. So that might be the most hopeful.
Yeah. And of course, Esperanto met its effective end when William Shatner was in the 1966 movie Incubus, which was recorded in Esperanto.
Oh my God, I thought I'd read one that the French didn't like Esperanto because the French language was considered at the time to sort of be the lingua franca, right? Isn't that what
yes.
it means?
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
The idea that was going to be the closest thing to an international language, and if we adopted Esperanto, the French would lose out, kind of, and they ended up losing out anyway because English became the lingua franca. Yeah. But can you imagine? I do think today, once again, this is how my mind works. If we had actually done that back in the 20s and all learned the same language and all spoke the same language today, what would that be like? That'd be interesting.
I don't know. I think, it may be good that we really can't understand each other.
Like Google Translate would be a whole different program, huh?
That's it would be translating us into, dead languages so we could get away from
it. Or it'd be accent maintenance to try to understand the Indian accent for Esperanto versus the Scandinavian one.
Yeah. So a final question, I think you've effectively answered this, but let me put it to you directly. What's the function of history for you? Is it, we can always talk about extremes and the truth is almost always in the middle, but do we learn from the past so that we don't repeat it, as Santayana might say, or do we when we focus on the past, we end up in a doom loop. And this is, Faulkner's idea, who has a character say, the past isn't dead. It's not even past. I mean, what do we gain by studying the past? And is it mostly that we're making new mistakes or what?
Well, yes, sort of. I mean, I truthfully look at it more like the past is there to teach us what can happen, right? So it's a little like showing you the black swan phenomenon in terms of examples. So when you say something like, well, how could this go sideways on us? You have examples you can point to in terms of worst case scenario. I mean, what the past doesn't teach are the kinds of lessons that most people want it to teach. So for example, you'll often hear someone say something like, well, we know appeasement doesn't work because look what happened with Hitler in the, late 1930s. But that's not what history teaches you, because you're not taking into account the variables, right? First of all, Hitler's a person. All dictators are not exactly the same, right? And all circumstances aren't exactly the same. So you can't turn around and say, well, we learned from Munich that you can't appease dictators, therefore we shouldn't appease Saddam Hussein because he's going to act exactly like Hitler acted, and we know that because Hitler acted that way. It doesn't work like that. Now, what it can show you is what a worst case scenario might look like if things go sideways like they did in the late 1930s. So, I mean, I think context, this is what history really teaches you, is how contextually things get involved. And so you can say things like, well, when we see, for example, rights being taken away from people in a society, like political parties being banned, or safeguards that keep people from being able to be thrown into prison without any sort of due process, I think history teaches you what's going to follow next in most of those cases, right? It's benign. So, but that doesn't teach you anything specifically. It teaches you sort of generalities, but I do think it's useful in that sense. Now, the Santayana quote about, if you do not learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. I think one, it doesn't work that way because we take the wrong lessons, right? Like you can't use dictators because of Munich. I also think that people use history to have it prove what they want it to prove, which goes back a little bit like what you were saying earlier, that you have these ideas that you could go back and construct it in ways or you can choose historical approaches in ways that lets you say 2 + 2 = 5 if you want it to. Mm. There's an old line that even the devil can quote scripture for his purposes, and history is far more subject to that than biblical narratives are, right? So I that's why I think you have to be careful about this idea about history teaches X, Y, or Z, and become suspicious of the teacher that teaches you that. There are things to learn, but they're much more amorphous and much less specific. And so that's what I would say. And then the idea, though, that it could hurt you to learn from the past, well, it can, depending on what they're trying to teach you and what they, you know, especially, you know, give it a sideways glance and ask what the person trying to teach you about the past is trying to get you to, you know, is he trying to get me to say that 5 is the answer?
Right.
But broader generalization that we talked about earlier, that when I talk to kids about context and how things evolve, I think those are really valuable lessons, but they're not very useful necessarily in applying specifically to individual cases. Does that make sense?
It certainly does. And I think we're going to end it there. I want to thank you, Dan Carlin, the proprietor, the creator, the entrepreneur, the auteur behind Hardcore History, for talking to Reason.
Well, thank you for having me again. Another good conversation, Nick.
You can sign up for our other podcast series, including the Reason Roundtable, the SOA Forum Debates, Just Asking Questions, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and even The Best of Reason, where a robotic AI voice trained on Catherine Mangu Ward's vocal utterances reads new great stories from Reason. So go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up. Subscribe to all of them. Thanks for listening.